You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and as I say, for the rest of the hour, we're going to get you up to speed on the latest AIDS, HIV news. It has been, it's hard to believe, it's been 25 years since French scientists announced the discovery of HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. And since then, it has been a daunting nut to crack, this virus. Researchers have tried to get a basic understanding of how it operates so they can figure out how to stop it. Treatment, of course, from the very beginning was a high priority, while the search for a vaccine came later. And that's been a very frustrating and unsuccessful search so far. The recent failure of two clinical trials suggests that a vaccine is not around the corner. So in the meantime, doctors have struggled to manage a disease that has reached epidemic proportions, especially in the developing world. But thanks to treatments that keep the virus in check, HIV/AIDS can be managed as a chronic disease, at least for those of us who have access and can afford the life-saving medications. And some prevention strategies are working, others are not. Which ones are they? We'll talk about all of this stuff for the rest of the hour. If you'd like to get in on our conversation, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And in Second Life, you can join us in Science Friday. Look for our Science Friday Island there and step up to the group of folks sitting in the chairs and sit down and you can ask your question.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
John Moore is professor of microbiology and immunology at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University here in New York. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Moore.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ira. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
You're welcome. Sarah Schlesinger is an associate professor of clinical investigation at Rockefeller University and the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center in New York. She joins us today from Raleigh, North Carolina. Good to see you again, Dr. Schlesinger.
Ira, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. And hi, John.
Hi, sir.
I'm surprised you know each other.
We're old friends. Research community for a long time.
I'm sure. Let's talk about this, the disappointing setback for the AIDS vaccine in recent months, the failure of in one clinical trial run by Merck, another one in South Africa. Dr. Schlesinger, what's happened here?
Well, I think that the trial to which you refer is really one trial that failed or didn't get the result that we hoped, and another trial that was stopped before it really began. So the trial to which you refer was a phase 3 or an efficacy trial of what was regarded by many people in our field as the most promising vaccine candidate. And a candidate is any vaccine that is not licensed. And that was a vaccine to prevent HIV infection that was based on an adenovirus, a different virus, a common virus that causes colds, that was genetically engineered to contain 3 genes from HIV. And this was a promising candidate. It had been tested in small animals and non-human primates, and it had gone through extensive evaluation in small trials in people as well, and it had been moved forward in an efficacy or a field trial, which is the only way to know if a vaccine actually works. So an efficacy trial is a trial where you go into an area where many people are getting infected, you evaluate that rate of infection, you then, of course, for ethical reasons, bring in all of what's necessary to reduce that infection with the methods we know, education, clean needles, condoms, etc. And then you come back with your vaccine, and with informed consent, you ask people who you know to be at risk, either to receive the vaccine or to receive what's called a placebo or an inert. In this case, it was just salt water. And then you follow those people, and you see who gets infected, usually over 2 years, sometimes a little bit longer. And if all of your infections, because you know that from your research that these people are likely to get infected, occur in those who received the placebo, then the vaccine worked. And if they recur, or if they occur equally in the two groups, then you know your vaccine didn't work. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, in this trial, not only did the vaccine not serve to protect the people who we had hoped that it might protect, there was a small group of people who had pre-existing immunity to the adenovirus, the vector, if you will, for the vaccine, that were made more susceptible to HIV infection by receiving the vaccine. So this was the vaccine trial itself, I think, was not a failure because, like any experiment, you don't know the answer till you start it, and it got an answer, it was not the answer we wanted.
Well, that's the question I have. It's sort of like, why go into a trial if you don't think you know something about how it's going to work?
Well, I mean, that's the $64,000 question. And of course, one never does an experiment to which one knows the answer,
yeah.
Whether it's an experiment in the laboratory or whether it's a human clinical trial. If we knew the answer, we wouldn't have to do the work. And that's the conundrum. One of the great challenges of developing HIV vaccines is we really don't know what works until we move forward to human clinical testing. There are many kinds of information that we can gain before we get there. For instance, you know, how it performs in small animals. And one of the limitations is, unlike, say, with a tetanus shot, where we have what's called a correlate of protection. So if I give you a tetanus shot, I know that 2 weeks later I can draw your blood and I can measure what are called neutralizing antibodies, something about which John is extremely expert. And I know that if the titer, I think it's over 1 to 260, you're protected. And if it's not that, you're not. So if I have a new tetanus shot, I can get a small number of people together. I can give the old tetanus shot to some, of course, with informed consent. I can give the new tetanus shot to others. I can draw their blood. I can go into the laboratory, measure this antibody, and say, ah, this is better. I have a higher titer. It's lasting longer. It's more durable, you know, a variety of different things. Mm-hmm. That's called a correlate of protection. We know what to measure in the blood that correlates with protection from disease. So nobody's ever been exposed to tetanus. I haven't had to go into a group of people who are at risk for tetanus, because tetanus is a very low-risk disease, obviously. Mm-hmm. So because we know the correlate, we can move forward with great ease. Mm-hmm. There is no correlate of protection that we know. We don't know what the correlate of protection is for an HIV vaccine. Nobody has ever been protected from a vaccine.
Hmm.
We're trying to learn what the correlate is through a variety of different avenues of research. One of them is by looking at people who are naturally infected with HIV and control the virus. These people are called elite controllers. Another group of people, there are animals, non-human primates, who have been quite well protected by what is called a live attenuated vaccine. That's a virus that's killed a little bit or disabled, and that seems to confer pretty good protection in non-human primates, but it's not safe, and so therefore we can't move it into people. So from those two groups of people and non-human primates, we can gather some information, but we don't really know what a correlate is.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the great challenges. The other problem that we have, one of the other problems, is we don't have a good animal model. So we have non-human primates who get viruses that are like HIV, but none get AIDS from HIV. So we don't have, like, say, you would for anthrax. With anthrax, guinea pigs get a disease from anthrax that is almost identical to humans. So therefore, guinea pigs are the animal correlate for developing an anthrax vaccine. You can give them the vaccine, you give them anthrax. If they're protected, terrific. If they're not, you know you have to go back to the drawing board. We don't have that for HIV. So these two great challenges really are hamper our ability to move forward as we might with other vaccines.
It's fair to say that
Doctor,
we know
let me ask Dr. Moore a question.
Of useful information
why don't we know enough
the immune system,
about HIV
but
to
we don't
make
know
these
enough
things
yet to design vaccines that will induce that we know immunity extremely high and large amount of useful information on HIV and its interactions with the immune system.
I mean, there are two arms to the immune system.
We don't know enough
relevant
yet to design vaccines that will induce immunity and high T-cell immunity, which by and large is not likely to prevent infection.
I mean, there are two arms to the immune system
body
that become relevant
the consequences
antibodies
which prevent infection.
And the Merck vaccine
and the T-cell immunity, which by and
large in the field
is not likely
to
prevent infection,
but
is
designed
to induce
T-cell immunity.
It didn't induce antibody
immunity.
And the Merck
vaccine, it was never likely
to prevent infection,
you know,
known in the field as a
T-cell vaccine,
but it was considered reasonably
designed
likely
to
lead to a reduction in the extent of infection from people who
it was never
became
likely
infected
to prevent
after
vaccination.
So that's what we were really
looking
for.
The field
was
really
looking
to
lead to
a reduction
in the amount
of replication
of infections
from people who
became infected
after
who became
infected
on the trial.
So that's what we were really looking for, or the field was really looking for, a reduction in the amount of replication or of severity of infection in people who became infected on the trial. So that was the primary endpoint, really. And there was no such effect. Now, that then makes us all question why, because it's important to find out why it didn't work. And as Sarah mentioned, the really unexpected result that blindsided everyone was the enhancement of infection in a subset of individuals, so that more infections took place than were anticipated compared to placebo. And that really did take everyone by surprise and has caused a major exercise in navel scratching, head scratching over the past 6 months. It's been very tough to try to work this out, and there's still a lot of ongoing studies that will hopefully point to the reason for this very unexpected result. And it's important that we find out, because the next planned trial is a broadly similar trial conducted by the NIH of a similar but not identical adenovirus vector with an addition of a DNA boost, and there's now major debates going on about whether that should take place, whether and if so, in what format, because there's no point in reinforcing failure unless we're pretty sure that we're going to be able to do better. And those decisions are not yet taken. They're being actively discussed. There are committee meetings coming up later this month, because that's an important decision for the next several years of the field. Do we try another adenovirus vector, or do we hold our horses for a couple of years and try and come up with something better? It's an important decision.
So there's some key that's still missing here.
Well, yes,
several keys that are
several
still missing.
Keys.
I mean, we don't know how to induce neutralizing antibodies at a level and breadth that are sufficient. And realistically, the only way to prevent infection with a vaccine, to truly prevent an individual getting infected, is with a neutralizing antibody-based vaccine. That's not to say that a T-cell vaccine isn't useful, but it's not likely to prevent infection. And we don't know how to do this. I mean, we are learning more and more about the reasons why we don't know how to do it, and it's certainly not an impossible task. It's just an extraordinarily difficult one from the scientific perspective. Mm-hmm. The virus has learned to resist the action of neutralizing antibodies. It has to survive in a human organism that raises antibody responses against it, and it's evolved sophisticated to ward off those antibodies.
So does that mean we need to know just more basic research before we do this clinical trial?
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We need structures, for one thing. You know, there are a lot of efforts going on to crystallize or generate sophisticated electron micrographs of the envelope glycoproteins in their most native form. And it would really help to know, to see what we're trying to make. We're trying to engineer better versions of the envelope glycoproteins that are on the virus to act as superior immunogens. That's a major...
Those are the markers on the virus?
The parts of the virus that cause the virus to get into the cells it infects.
Right.
And which are also the parts of the virus to which the body makes an immune response.
I got you. Let me just jump in here for an ID. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with Sarah Schlesinger and John Moore. You want to continue on that? That's an interesting point. The part that, what, Sarah, you were saying?
The very part of the virus that binds to the cell, which allows it to infect the cell and frankly cause disease, is the same molecule that the body has to make an immune response to in order to fight it. So it serves both as a receptor and as an antigen. An antigen is anything that stimulates the immune system to make an immune response.
So it should, in theory, the body should be able to recognize that and glom right onto it.
Well, one would hope so, but the great success of this virus is that the body makes a vigorous immune response. I mean, in the beginning of the epidemic, you know, 25 years ago, people thought that the virus was able to evade immunity. That's not at all what occurs. There's a vigorous immune response. It's just not effective. It's not, the virus is able to evade the antibodies that are generated. And one of the points that John made, which I think is terribly important, is we have many vaccines against viruses that work very well. You know, the Jenner vaccine developed against smallpox in 1796, before anybody understood anything about cells, viruses, or the circulation of the blood, protected, you know, helped to eradicate smallpox. You know, measles, mumps, rubella. All of those vaccines induce immunity. They induce both antibody and cellular immunity. So John was referring to this as a vaccine that was designed to induce T-cell immunity. That's indeed the case. But it's my understanding, John, and please correct me if you have a different understanding, that vaccines that work induce robust immunity in both sides of the immune system.
Absolutely.
And that's really, you know, this vaccine and other candidates are able to induce some degree of T-cell response, but what we measure, you know, are tiny little blips if you compare them to what you get from a really good, robust vaccine, say like the yellow fever vaccine.
1-800-989-8255. A quick question before the break. Alex in Dearborn, Michigan. Hi, Alex.
Hello. I have a question about, there is a program about phages, which is basically viruses that kill viruses. Is there any kind of research to see if there is a virus out there that kills AIDS viruses?
John Moore?
This wouldn't work for HIV. Those phages work against bacteria. Bacteriophages kill bacteria. They don't kill other viruses. This wouldn't be an approach that would work for HIV. HIV is inert until it gets into the cells it infects. So you'd be asking for phages to kill the infected cells. I don't think that's a viable strategy.
You're still coming up, trying to come up with your own strategy.
Well, you know, it's not that we don't know what to do. We know what to do, we just don't know yet how to do it. I mean, as Sarah said, ideally a vaccine should induce both T-cell immunity and antibody immunity.
Yeah, describe the difference between those two, please. Describe.
Well, you have to design the immunogen in different ways because the two arms of the immune system are stimulated by different types of antigens. So it's difficult to make, you know, one type of vaccine that simultaneously does everything you want, and it may be better to go in and work with two half vaccines, as it were, and combine them. But so far, we're not succeeding in either arm. We don't have a good T-cell vaccine that's good enough, as the Merck results showed, and we certainly don't have an antibody-based vaccine that's yet good enough.
But, John, when one induces... So, Ira, you asked about the two arms of the immune system. One makes a vigorous immune response. One makes antibody, which is a protein that circulates in the blood but is a clear protein itself. And one also stimulates various different cells, which will kill by direct contact.
Uh-huh.
So the antibody that's made is often referred to as the humoral arm of the immune system, which actually goes back to the Hippocratic four humors, believe it or not. And cell-mediated immunity refers to the cells that actually have to find the infected cells that John mentioned. So when the caller asked about a phage lysing the bacteria, the infected cells, the HIV-infected cells, are lysed by direct contact with what are called CD8 or killer T cells.
All right. Stay with us. We're going to come back and take more questions and calls about the 25th anniversary of the discovery of the HIV virus. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. My guests are Sarah Schlesinger, Associate Professor of Clinical Investigation at Rockefeller University and the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center in New York, and John Moore, Professor of Microbiology and Immunology at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University here in New York. Our number 1-800-99-8255. Let's go to James in Hyannis, Massachusetts. Hi, James.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello, doctors. I'm calling. I was infected in 1981. I've lived my entire adult life with HIV, and what you were saying about the CD8 cells is very interesting to me because mine have been very high for a number of years, which are the suppressor cells. I'm just wondering if you've ever used any human beings for trials for vaccine, people with HIV.
We conduct human clinical trials, and there are two kinds of, well, there are many kinds, but in this regard, there are two kinds of trials. One are prophylactic trials or trials where you're using the vaccine to prevent people who are not infected from getting infected, and the other are therapeutic trials where you're using the vaccine to help to stimulate the immune system of people who are already infected. And both kinds of trials have been conducted. It's generally considered that it is harder to control a virus that's already infected a person than it is to prevent infection, that it's a higher immunologic bar. But with that said, from the beginning of vaccine development, there have been trials conducted by others. I conduct trials of vaccines for prevention. Colleagues of mine, though, have conducted several clinical trials of what were considered to be promising candidate vaccines in people who were infected in the hope of helping to modulate their infection.
Right, and, so I sort of thought, I mean, I feel like I should be researched because, I mean, I'm healthy.
Yeah.
My
viral
load is undetectable for over
10 years. What brought your disease under control?
Did you say you were in Boston?
I live in,
Hyannis?
Hyannis.
Yeah, and when you're near Boston, it's a major center.
Actually, I just returned from, I was in a research study conducted by MIT and Mass General about metabolic study. So I offer myself as often as I can. But, and I've asked those researchers there, you know, they think I'm an interesting person because I've survived and done so well also. But, I'm just curious about whether or not, you know, is there any interest in using people who have survived, maybe their blood has, you know,
Well, there's a major research effort going on in several cities, but near you at the Massachusetts General Hospital, the Elite Controller Study run by Bruce Walker, that actively seeks people with your characteristics to try why you've been so healthy for so long.
Any hints, Dr. Moore? Why? And there are a number of people like him.
Well,
who have...
it's a few percent of HIV-infected people are what is known as long-term non-progressors or elite controllers whose immune systems have been able to control the virus, and it's important to understand why that is. And they, in general, have, quote, better immune systems, and the details of that are incredibly important, and that's what's actively being researched.
Mm-hmm. What about the other treatments? Are they successful? We've heard for years about the cocktail treatment given to people with HIV. Do we know why they're successful and how long they work for?
Sure. I mean, the treatment has been the success story of the HIV/AIDS era. I mean, the drugs that are available nowadays are just so much better than the first generation that were introduced in the 90s. There's new drugs approved every year now of different characteristics, better properties. They work well in combination. They're less toxic. They're easier to take. It's more convenient. So for people in the States who can afford the best health care around, HIV/AIDS is a manageable infection for many, many years. How long that will remain so is yet to be determined by the course of events in the future. But
you put a good you put an interesting caveat on that. You said that people in the United States who can afford it, whereas abroad in Africa, they is raging out of control.
Sure, and the issue is getting drugs rolled out into the countries that need them, and that's financial and logistical issues that really are not science in the sense of the drugs exist. It's a political
and social and political and cultural as well.
It's all of the things that are dealt with by other sections of the HIV community, HIV research and treatment community.
And those are tremendously daunting problems. The ability to treat the infection with HIV is really one of the great scientific and medical breakthroughs of our time. You know, I was a young doctor in the beginning of the epidemic, and it was like Camus' plague. I mean, people came in, young people came in dying, and there was nothing we can do. And now people are treated and leading lives of, you know, great, great promise and great productivity, and they have to take their medication, and they have to, you know, comply. But as John said, it's a chronic disease. When you go abroad, when you go to South Asia or Southeast Asia or particularly Sub-Saharan Africa, it's like going back to 1985.
Mm-hmm. Tammy in Grand Rapids. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a person who lived with and was exposed to the HIV virus through my partner who eventually died of AIDS, and I never contracted the disease at all. So my question is, why are scientists not studying people like me who've had chronic exposure but didn't come down with the virus? And I'm going to take my question off the air. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, again, people who are exposed but uninfected have been and are sought for research studies. I mean, there are a number of cohorts in the States which do study those reasons and cohorts abroad. I don't know of any studies that are going on in your part of the world, but they surely exist because it's important to find out.
But there's a website from the NIH, clinicaltrials.gov, and if you go to that website, there's a comprehensive list of clinical trials going on, or a relatively comprehensive list. Like John, I'm not aware of a study of what are called highly exposed but persistently seronegative individuals in your particular area, but you might be able to find something on that website.
1-800-999-8255. So the fact that we have effective treatments for people with who are infected with HIV, maybe not cheap enough to be able to afford, the whole world can afford to, politically as economically speaking, is vaccination where the attention is now being most paid to?
Well, there's no question that we need the vaccine if we're going to essentially beat the epidemic. I mean, the only way to eventually beat it is to prevent new infections taking place, and the vaccine is the most promising, or certainly the most appealing way of doing this. It's also extraordinarily difficult, so it's not going to be achieved for many years. But it's not time to give up and go home. It's the benefits are so great that we need to continue to work on this, despite some claims in the press that it's time to give up on vaccines. It's certainly not, in my opinion.
I couldn't agree with John more. I mean, I think we need to have both a long-term and a short-term strategy. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the worst epidemic that's hit mankind, with the possible exception of the plague. 25 million people have died already. And the reality of it, despite the utility of the drugs, as John said, the only way to end the epidemic definitively would be a vaccine, but it's likely a long way off. So it would seem to me that we need to have a long-term strategy to, as John mentioned earlier, return to basics. As my mentor, Ralph Steinman, likes to say, learn the rules of immunity, learn how we make a good immune response, both from T cells and antibody, and then apply those rules to make a vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
But while we're doing that in our laboratories and in our small clinical trials units, there's an epidemic raging, and we have to address that epidemic with the tools we have.
And let's talk about some of those tools. One of the more interesting, promising prevention strategies turned out to be male circumcision. Is that an effective tool?
Yes, it is an effective tool, and the reason we do clinical trials and we do experiments is because we don't know the answer. But yes, there have been now, I believe, 3 clinical trials in Africa that have demonstrated clearly that male circumcision is protective, but only partially protective. And this is part of the great challenge with which we're grappling, that male circumcision reduces the rate of infection of men, depending on the trial, about 60%. So it's not the 90 or 100% one would hope for, but in Botswana or Swaziland, where, you know, a huge number of people are infected, in the 9 sub-Saharan African countries with the highest rates of infection, 12% of the adult population are infected. And in the most affected countries, it's even higher, like closer to 30 or 40. So if you're looking at reducing that by 60%, you're saving, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands, if not millions of lives,
mm-hmm.
but it's not completely effective. So you have to use that and combine it still with education, with voluntary counseling and testing, with condom use. And those are very hard things to do. A vaccine, in its ideal form, you give once and you go home and the person's protected for life. You know, and that's sort of the holy grail to which we all aspire. But as John said, it's a long way off. So how you roll out, you know, imagine asking adult men to be circumcised in resource-poor areas where, you know, even dental work isn't done. I mean, that's a huge logistical, medical, mm-hmm. social, political issue. And then those men are only partially protected. So one has to be very careful with the communications and the education message so people understand that and that they still need to use condoms. And one of the other most effective tools is to reduce the number of partners. So in epidemiologic and social prevention studies conducted by people who do work very unlike what John or I do, it's been shown that that's also one of the most effective tools. So to educate people in that regard is, you know, tremendously sensitive, very difficult, but, you know, yet tremendously important and what we have to offer today.
John, you want to chime in?
Yeah, and it's important not to forget that it's not uniquely an African or Asian epidemic.
No.
Far from it.
Absolutely.
In the States, the areas of the community that most would benefit from increased education and increased uptake of antiretroviral drugs are the African American communities, and the rates of taking up drugs or the rates of preventing mother-to-child transmission and so forth are much lower than in the rest of America. And that's one of the issues here that we need to address, is a distrust of establishment medicine that goes back to many years of distrust of physicians by the African American community. And one of the reasons in the HIV AIDS area is what Pastor Wright raised in the embarrassed Barack Obama recently, the notion that, you know, HIV is a creation of the U.S. government to kill black people. And that, unfortunately, has become a more and more pervasive view because of the views of Pastor Wright and so on. And it's interesting to go back to this myth and see where it came from. It was originally a KGB disinformation plot working with the East German secret police, the Stasi, back in the late 1980s at the height of the Cold War. It was a myth created by the Russians to embarrass America in Africa.
All right, Dr. I have to jump in and remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato, talking with John Moore and Sarah Schlesinger. Let me see if I can get a quick phone call in before we have to go to Ron in San Francisco. Hi, Ron.
Hi. You know, this is really interesting. The vaccine is going to be important, but right now out here in San Francisco with the Hope and Beyond's I Am Getting Tested, Are You project, which is focusing on all generations, focusing on destigmatizing the disease, and our main concern here for research is why haven't we really focused on providing a test that everyone can use inexpensively for this reason, what we call the hidden factor of HIV infection, where there are no symptoms or very little symptoms for young people who are new to sexual maturity, who are in great numbers, who could go for years without being aware that they are infected. We need to drive the testing forward and drive the testing procedures forward so there's privacy maintained so we can overcome this disease while research can find a way to create a vaccine.
Absolutely. What you say is very important, and you remind me, early in the epidemic, the Holy Grail was a test. That was the first great accomplishment before we even dreamed of therapy or a vaccine, was a simple diagnostic test. And to this day, you know, testing is a tremendously important part of any prevention strategy. And there have been, you know, quite a number of leaps forward in terms of testing. There is now the Oroquick test, which doesn't require blood. It can be done from a sort of a scraping inside the mouth. And I believe there's a campaign by the CDC to increase the amount of testing and destigmatize, you know, getting tested, as well, of course, as being diagnosed as positive. But those are, you know, those are hard things to do, and
No amount of tests, available tests, will help encourage somebody who doesn't want to be tested.
Exactly. And you know, again, you get into the realm of behavior and values, and these are very sensitive areas. I mean, one of the great challenges of this virus is it's associated with behaviors that in some ways are stigmatized. And it's made it more difficult to treat and to prevent for the very reason that you mentioned.
John, any last words?
No, Sarah's right. I mean, testing is another success story. The tests are 99.8% accurate, and anyone who feels that they are at risk of HIV infection should be tested and learn whether or not they need to modify their behavior or go on to antiretroviral therapy. I mean, it's best done in physicians' offices, but there are tests that can be purchased from quick tests, but still best done in the care of a licensed physician.
Well, thank you both for taking time to talk with us. I appreciate your comments. Sarah Schlesinger, Associate Professor of Clinical Investigation at the Rockefeller University and the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center here in New York. John Moore, Professor of Microbiology and Immunology at the Cornell Weill Medical College of Cornell University. Have a good weekend, and thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Ira, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ira.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarian Keem Molesky. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we're podcasting and blogging and putting up all kinds of new videos. Also, special treat, we're going to be on the road next week in Milwaukee. at the Public Museum in Milwaukee. If you want to know details, go to Wisconsin Public Radio's website. Easy to find, Wisconsin Public Radio. Click on the wacky picture of me there on the webpage, and you can get information about how to get tickets for seeing us in Milwaukee next week. We'll be talking about Great Lakes and beer. So, what a great combination to talk about in Milwaukee. Stay with us. Next week, we'd like to see you in the audience. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flato in New York.